Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment. And on this show, every week, we connect the dots between everything that's going on in our greater world and our personal well-being. We talk about food, water, air, and earth. We talk about agriculture, industrial vectors, public policy, the state of our communities, the state of our health, the state of our environment. And each week on the show, we talk with different experts and thought leaders, scientists and authors, filmmakers and advocates about all of the different things going on in our world that have both short-term and long-term impact on our health and well-being and that of our families and our children and future generations. And that's the theme of today's show. As always, we've been on the air for 8 years or so and have a terrific archive filled with wonderful conversations with terrific thought leaders and guests. So please do check that out as well. Today we are going to be returning to a theme that I have been covering a great deal on this show. And since I'll introduce our guest in just a minute, since this is a Thanksgiving show, in addition to both the kind of good news and bad news that we will be discussing on this show, which is, you know, the bad news being the way that we're going about things that is, in effect, destructive to well-being and life on Earth. And the good news is the ways that that can be addressed if enough people really participate and collaborate and join forces to push our societal choices in the right direction. The extra good news is that today's guest is a returning guest on our show. I'm so happy to have him back for reasons we'll be discussing in the program. This is our Thanksgiving live broadcast. So, you know, enjoy or, you know, feast day, which is how the indigenous people celebrate since the Western Thanksgiving is not a happy historical experience or memory for them. And so, love and solidarity going out to our Native and Indigenous relatives worldwide, as well as to the rest of us. May we celebrate in community and also, you know, redress the wrongs of history, which keep coming up in so many different ways. Our guest on today's show is Josh Tickell. He's a Sundance Award-winning film director, best-selling author, and a thought leader. One of the things I love about Josh is that he, you know, focuses on big picture social issues, you know, rather than just, you know, the sort of individual thing we can do at home. That's a constant theme on Connect the Dots. The issues he has focused on include alternative energy, conscious capitalism, if such a thing is even possible, doable, and reversing climate change. His movies have won multiple major awards, and he himself speaks in all kinds of different locations, both in the media and in educational institutions and businesses. Today, we're going to be discussing his new upcoming book, which we've released in 2017 in the month of November, which is right here and now. The book is called Kiss the Ground, How the Food You Eat Can Reverse Climate Change, Heal Your Body, and Save the World. And it's also being turned into a movie by executive producer and environmental stalwart Leonardo DiCaprio, which will also be entitled Kiss the Ground. Welcome back to Connect the Dots. Josh, it's so great to have you with us.
Thank you, Allison. Great to hear your voice and great to be on with these wonderful listeners you have here.
Well, thank you. The last time we did the show, and I'm just going to backtrack to this because you and your wife, Rebecca, had really been important players in raising awareness. And this goes back, gosh, 6 or 7 years ago to the Gulf oil spill of 2010. I covered that on the Huffington Post. You guys were on the ground, you know, and while the public was receiving assurances about, you know, how quickly this would be handled and how safe it all was, you were going out and kind of turning the rock over, being, you know, right there, seeing what was happening, what was going on. And that was when both of you came to join us here on Connect the Dots. And actually, we recorded that show or did that show live in studio. So we really got to meet in person and, you know, really talk. And at that time, I learned that you had taken, it had taken tremendous courage. All of this takes courage. It takes heart and it takes courage. And, you know, we all need to cultivate a lot more of both to deal with our current times. At the time, you guys had gone on the ground and in the course of doing that into a toxic region. And it's not the only one. You know, the number of toxic regions we have are growing constantly. We'll be discussing that today. But you went on the ground in the aftermath of that spill and were yourselves toxically exposed. I was heartbroken to learn that this beautiful young couple, starting a beautiful life together, cared so much for the planet and for the future of all children, that you guys had taken risks that could have possibly meant that you yourselves, would not have been able to have a family. So I literally remember crying when I realized that. In such admiration and caring for the care that you guys showed. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that from that time and then flashing forward to, you know, how that journey has been and where you are today?
Sure. You know, it's funny to look back, gosh, what was that, 2010 oil spill, and here we are almost 8 years later. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Rebecca, my wife and I, we are co-directors and co-producers in our film company, Big Picture Ranch, and that's bigpictureranch.com. And we made this film called The Big Fix about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. While we were there, we were, you know, exposed to a tremendous amount of Corexit, which is the toxic chemical spray used to disperse the oil. And the funny thing about these chemicals is whether they're used in oil spills or agriculture, the byline is always the same. It's always that, you know, if you're listening and you've heard this from a chemical spray or chemical company, you need to really investigate, because the claim is universal. It's always less toxic than table salt. It always biodegrades in water, or it biodegrades in sunlight. That's the byline. And, of course, what we know about heavy toxins, dioxins, all of the various asides, you know, the pesticides, herbicides, and other chemicals that are used to affect change in our world, is, for the most part, they're not long-term tested. They're tested in rats and for something called an LD50, which is a low-dosage toxicity. And none of these chemicals work at a low dosage or at a high dosage at an acute level. They work in a bioaccumulating way. So very rarely are they studied longitudinally. And when we study them longitudinally, we universally see the same results, which is toxic environmental stressors trigger an epigenetic trait, such as cancer, lymphoma, leukemia, and that epigenetic trait is then expresses itself as some form of disease in the body. So when we look at the rise, and I'm taking this from the oil spill all the way to sort of our current situation in the United States, us, we were exposed multiple times over the course of filming, which took place over 6 months or something. And my wife, Rebecca, developed symptoms. She had rash on her chest. She had, she had doctors tell her that her RNA was damaged and that it would likely affect child, you know, rearing and childbirth and all of that. And we had some complications with our first child and thought that we may have a deformed child. We were very blessed in that all of those complications happened and we still had a great child. We have two now. So many other people who were sprayed and lived in that area were not as blessed. So we see an increase in areas that have heavy use of, you know, Corexit. We see an increase in all sorts of deformities and miscarriages. So let's fast forward to our current work with Kiss the Ground. One of the shocking things that we saw as we investigated the Kiss the Ground book and the Kiss the Ground movie. Kiss the Ground movie comes out next year. Kiss the Ground book is out now. You can buy it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. How the quantity of pesticides and herbicides per American has shot up. It has shot up directly in correlation with the incidence of cancer in this country. Now, people could say, well, that's a spurious correlation because the incidence of organic foods has also shot up in this country. And you could say, yes, that's true. Many things have increased. But here's the level of increase. We now spray and use 3 pounds per American per year of toxic chemicals on our food. And so we know when we look at epigenetic traits, we know it's got to be triggered by an environmental factor. The largest dose and the largest ongoing dose of any environmental factor that people in the United States are receiving is through the toxic chemicals that go onto our food. So I don't care what you correlate it to other than that. That is by far, by weight, by mass, by dose, the heaviest dose that we're getting. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out if cancers and these other things are caused by epigenetic traits, which are triggered by environmental factors. You look at the biggest environmental factor first, and that's what's being sprayed on our food.
So we have basically followed a through line from your work down in the Big Six at the Gulf, looking at the chemicals there, all the way through to, it's basically that same year. That was really a benchmark year, 2010, for people who were conscious and concerned about these issues, because that was also the year that the president's cancer panel determined that the least studied area in terms of cancer inducement or versus prevention was the unstudied and unresearched over 80,000 toxic chemicals that, due to industry pressure, have never been given the scientific due diligence. And so you have been following that thread all the way through. And, we're always told, just like what you said, there are all these little statements, it's a little of this, it's a little of that, your body can get rid of it. We know many of these are persistent. The body can't get rid of them. It can accumulate in the body. So, we spent billions of dollars on a cancer treatment industry, but so little and so inadequate on prevention, and yet we are continually being exposed. Where are, for example, rates on cancer right now in neurological ailments, for example? Do you have any idea, are these rates rising because of this constantly rising use of the chemicals we're talking about?
Well, they are rising, and if we look at the recent research, what we see is a diversion from the tried and true statement that cancers are caused by genetics. Cancers are an inherited trait. The more research that gets done, and this is kind of a spinoff of the billions of dollars that is being spent on cancer treatment, is eventually somebody picks up the pieces and they begin to follow the breadcrumbs and go, well, why is this being caused? And because really smart geneticists are looking at this, they're going, oh, wait up, no, this is not going through a hereditary process. There is no way that we could attribute the spike in cancers in the United States to a hereditary, trait that is being passed on. That is an implausible connection. But when geneticists talk about genetics, they separate, hereditary genetics from epigenetics. Epigenetics is a trait that is inherent in your body, but it is turned on or off by environmental factors. So cancer, to a large degree, is now being understood to be an epigenetic trait, something that is inherent in many, if not all of us, but can be switched on according to environmental factors. So this is the breaking research. This is the new information that has come out of the multi-billion dollar Let's Heal Cancer push, which, of course, you can't heal something until you know why it's being caused. Thankfully, people are looking at the causes, and they're realizing, wow, something in our environment, not our hereditary, not our parents, something in our environment is leading to this spike.
This is so familiar. because I've been involved from very early on in, you know, the quest to improve our health through improving our nutrition and diet, and have been acquainted with many approaches to diet. I was actually working, it's over a decade ago, on a groundbreaking book by the leading expert on childhood obesity. And, you know, we have a childhood obesity epidemic as well as an adult obesity epidemic. And it was the very same thing. The, you know, the standard belief of the time was that it's just your genes that make you fat. And this doctor, who's a leading Harvard scientist, was saying, our genes haven't changed. What's changed is what we are giving them, what, you know, we are exposing them to, whether it's unhealthy food ingredients, toxic chemicals, radiation. These are the kinds of things. The way the body works is like they are not good for us, because when we're exposed to them and when we accumulate them in our bodies, then the very genes that you're talking about get the wrong ones that create the health problem in your body get turned on, and the ones that help prevent that get turned off, but by the very same groups and types of chemicals. In other words, it doesn't occur miraculously, for example, that, you know, BPA disrupts hormones, but on the other hand, you know, it kind of is anti-inflammatory and helps the body readjust. No. Usually, you know, we're always taught through pharmaceutical science to look for one pill, one fix, one answer. But in fact, these things act in multiple ways, and they interact with each other. Can you, you know, share a little bit with our listeners, you know, how all of that is actually going on with us, so that the day that comes when we say, whoa, ho, I have symptoms or disease, or, you know, someone has symptoms or a disease, it didn't just happen overnight. It's been a long time coming.
Yes. Well, and again, you know, this is all inside of the research that we did. Our goal was to learn about soil. You know, that's where mm-hmm. we started with Kiss the Ground. And mm-hmm. once you start learning about soil, the first thing you learn is our health and soil health are intimately connected. So if you find degraded soils where food is being grown, if you find soils that are full of chemicals, they're acidic, they're full of salt, guess what? Guess what? The food that we're eating from those soils is bad for us, and our bodies are going to be a reflection of that. And so that's where the diet issue came in so strongly, is if you look at the United States, and I'll get back to your question, we have 915 million production acres of agriculture. That is huge. That's almost, you know, a billion acres, tremendous quantity of land. And if we look at that land, about 60-70% of it is turning to desert. It's desertifying. It's becoming very, very salt-ridden. I was just in the middle of Oklahoma, went out to farm fields, and literally, you pick up the farm field, you dig your hand into the ground, and it's silt. It's dust. There is no soil. So that's the middle of the country. 80 years after the Dust Bowl, we're still not recovered. And when you realize, wow, the microbes in the soil are the same as the microbes in our gut. The chemicals mm-hmm. that we're spraying on the soil go into the foods that we eat. That goes into our gut. And so you just mentioned the obesity epidemic. Look at how humans react to toxins. Look at how animals react to toxins. It is a natural defense mechanism when an animal encounters a poison, that poison is stored in fat cells. So mm-hmm. as we've increased these toxins on our food, we can see a direct correlation to the obesity epidemic in the United States. Now, that also has to do with an imbalance of omega-6 and omega-3 oils. The unhealthy omegas are coming from the same crops that we're growing, the soy oil, the corn oil, the canola oil. These oils are absolutely deleterious to the health of the body. They increase inflammation. They're also deleterious to the health of the soil because we grow them in monocrops and we spray them with chemicals. So it's all connected, and that's what we show in Kiss the Ground, the book, kisstheground.com. But I think the biggest aha is that all of this can be reversed, both for our bodies and for the soil.
Mm. That's really incredible. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But I just wondered, you know, on the one hand, there's this myth, you know, we have to have this, or, you know, it's been put out there, there has to be this mass monocrop agriculture to feed the world. This is going to feed the world. We need to export it everywhere. We need to have genetically modified seeds and all of the rest of it because we are feeding the world. But what you're describing doesn't sound like a good long-range plan to feed the world. It sounds like long-range growing agriculture done in this manner is actually depleting the soil so that we are not going to be able to feed people long-term or even, you know, in the near short-term. We're, you know, burning out the soil, as it were, and this has, you know, effects for the food supply. It has effects for climate. You know, which maybe we should discuss next, because, but behind that is all this thing, and, you know, we see this everywhere where this kind of information is shared, and then somebody will say, but we have to feed the world. You know, are we feeding the world? Is this method going to be viable for feeding the world?
Well, that's the big question. That's the million-dollar question, and of course, you hit on the critical point, which is short-term versus long-term thinking. Short-term, the green seed revolution, which started in the late 1970s, early 1980s with GMOs, increased chemical pesticides, increased fertilizers, that revolution short-term on a per-acre, per-bushel basis has increased caloric output on the acres that it has measured. So, yes, you've increased calories, but here's what's also increased. So I was just, as I mentioned, out in Oklahoma, talking to farmers about how much glyphosate, how much Roundup they're spraying. When Roundup was introduced, they were spraying somewhere around, you know, ounces per acre, you know, 3, 4, 5 ounces per acre. Now, same acres, very little change in production, just a small increase in production. They're spraying between 24 and 48 ounces an acre, sometimes up to 2 pounds an acre.
Hmm.
Now, the increase in production has not increased that much, but the chemical has increased 5x, 10x from when they started using it. So to maintain production levels, when you look at synthetic nitrogen, when you look at synthetic pesticides and fertilizer, synthetic pesticides and herbicides, there has been an exponential increase in these synthetics to get an incremental increase in calories. Now let's go big picture. Let's look out at the whole planet, right? 1975, we had 6.5 billion acres of arable land, meaning farmable land on the planet. We now have 5 billion acres of arable land. We lost 33% of our arable land since the green seed revolution began. So my question back to people who propose that GMOs, chemicals, this revolution that took place is working. My question to them is, why are we using 10x inputs to get a very small increase in calories per acre? And why, if this revolution worked, have we lost one-third of our land? If it worked, if it really worked, we would have gained one-third more land. We would have increased soil fertility. We would have increased water-holding capacity. We would have increased the microbial populations in the soil, and we would have more nutrient-dense food instead of less nutrient-dense food, because while we've increased calories, nutrient density has plummeted, because unless you have microbial life in the soil, the microbes cannot convey to the plant the critical vitamins and minerals the plant needs. So essentially what we've done is we've destroyed the vast majority of our soils. We're propping the crops up that we're planting with tremendous quantities of chemical inputs, both to keep the pests and funguses away and to keep the plant just growing, because the soil has lost so much nutrition. So now we eat those, you know, we process those foods, then the vast majority of what's grown in the United States is fed to cattle and chicken. So we process them, we feed them to cattle and chicken, we eat the cattle and chicken, and of course, that meat that is the majority result of the majority of crops that we're growing is devoid of all of the things that if you eat meat, it should have in it. And of course, if you don't eat meat, that's a natural reaction to a system that is completely broken. So, herein lies the rub. The claim that we're going to feed the world is completely going the opposite direction. We have 3 billion more people and one-third less land. That's what the green seed revolution worked. So if you're working for a GMO company, if you're working for a chemical company, go do this. Go out to one of the fields where your product is used, not in a test plot in your, you know, pretty little complex where you work. Go out to Oklahoma. Go out to Indiana. Go out to Idaho. Go out to Ohio. Walk out beyond the highway. Go out into the middle of the field. Look down. And what you will see between those crops is bare dirt. Stick your hand in it. And if it falls through your hand like sand, that's what we're destroying. That's what your chemical GMO green seed revolution has brought us. Dead dirt.
You know, let's just talk for a moment about dirt. We don't have to go into it too extensively because I want to refer listeners. We've done like three prior shows on the subject of soil, thanks to the recent move and to change the rules on the organic standards that the USDA enforces to assure the integrity of our organic food supply. And they recently made the bad for us, good for certain corporate industrial food suppliers choice of stating that organic food no longer needed to be grown in soil. So we've had several shows where we're talking about soil and the benefits of soil. But, you know, I think it can't be said enough because, you know, it's been an education for people about where their food comes from. Not everyone has access to farms or is in a location where it isn't all kind of highwayed or suburbanized or urbanized over. You know, some people would think that soil is just dead and lifeless. You know, of course it's just dirt. There's nothing else going on there. Can you kind of enlighten us a little bit about that, please?
Sure, and it's funny. We just did a live cast. Myself and Finian Makepeace, the co-founder of the Kiss the Ground nonprofit, which is at kisstheground.com. That's the inspiration for the book. We just did a live cast on Facebook yesterday, and he was saying that soil is sexy. This is his thesis. So, you know, soil is this incredible, you know, good healthy soil is this incredible bazaar of life forms. In a handful of really healthy soil, there are more microorganisms than all humans who have ever lived. So that is a tremendous, tremendous quantity of life. And even in a teaspoon of healthy soil, you're getting billions of life forms. So you've got this incredible world below us, which in the 1960s, we thought we probably understood something like 10 or 20% of what was going on down there. Today, the best soil scientists who have spent decades studying these interactions tell us that we understand less than 1/100th of what is happening in the soil, meaning the interactions, the life forms, the carbon exchanges. It is such a complicated, complex, incredible world that it actually makes, you know, looking up at the cosmos seem like a much simpler set of interactions. And that's really the incredible power that we've overlooked. So what is happening in the soil? In healthy soil, fungi, bacteria, microorganisms are all exchanging. There's an actual exchange of minerals and of carbon substrates. In healthy soil, a plant will pull in carbon dioxide. It'll put that carbon dioxide down through its root system and, put that carbon, it'll transfer it from carbon down through its root system, and that carbon is then handed off to different organisms, and a good portion of it in a healthy system will go down through the roots and will eventually, through microorganisms, make its way deep into the soil, into the recalcitrant factions of the soil, where it can stay for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. That is Mother Earth's natural carbon capture mechanism, and it works very, very well. In fact, in regenerative agriculture, which we show throughout the Kiss the Ground book, kisstheground.com, for those of you who want to get more information, that system can actually, when done correctly, over a period of 10 to 20 years, completely pull out about 500 gigatons of CO2 out of the atmosphere. That would pull the atmospheric concentration of CO2 down to 350 parts per million. That's where scientists tell us we need to be to live safely. So this is the only solution, the only one, that can deal with carbon dioxide on a large level, land-based, and actually store it long-term.
How hard is it to do it correctly, you know, in terms of, like, doing all the right things? Is that something, you know, that, I mean, I know that because of this easy sell of just spray this and it'll kill the bugs and you'll have a crop and all of that, the way we've gotten into the conventional monocrop agricultural system, you know, that has been appealing to farmers. You know, what is involved? How many years of effort? How difficult is it to actually, you know, turn this around? And, you know, and I guess the associated question is the hope that, you know, one by one by one, individual farmers will see this isn't fruitful for them, you know, or, you know, it has this tremendous potential that you describe, which is extraordinary and really planetary saving for all of us. But how hard will that be to, you know, to kind of bring it, bring about in a timely way, at a, you know, at enough of a volume, to really make that difference?
Well, that is the other million-dollar question. It is not difficult to do this correctly. It does require a rethinking of agriculture. It requires some simple steps with our agriculture. One is cover cropping, very simple, planting a cover crop of mixed seeds between actual harvests. That is not hard to do. Farmers know how to do that. Another one is not tilling the soil, using machines called no-till drills that actually place the seed into the ground versus ripping up the ground to place the seed in. John Deere makes them. They're exactly the same type of equipment as the tillage equipment. It's just a different mechanism that touches the ground. So they go behind regular tractors. They work the same way. They cost about the same amount. So there's not tilling, there's cover cropping, there's using, you know, taking away the synthetic fertilizers and using a combination of manure, compost, and nitrogen-fixing cover crops to put the nitrogen back in the soil. That's not rocket science. And then planting trees and another sort of long-term perennials around fields to help buffer and stabilize them. So none of these practices are exceptionally difficult, and all of them are known to farmers, and some of them are actually already done by farmers. Getting them done on the majority of United States and global agriculture is the question. And here's the real answer to that question. Very simple. Today, farmers in America, they have to make $20 an acre to stay on their farms. They have to make $20 an acre. The average farmer in America is making between 10 cents and $2 an acre. So once again, they have to make $20. They're making between 10 cents and $2 an acre. Well, who makes up the difference? And the simple answer is we do, taxpayers. We spend about 20 to 25 billion a year subsidizing farms. And that works out to about $1 million a farm per year. And so what we're doing is we're paying farmers to grow monocrops to feed to animals so that we can be sick and farmers can go out of business. That's the current model. Regenerative agriculture in the farms that it's being done on, which are combined farm-ranch operations. Gabe Brown's farm is a great example. It's twice the size of an average American farm, so this is a scale. This is a huge farm, 5,000 acres. He's making $100 an acre profit. $100 an acre on 5,000 acres is $500,000 in his pocket every year. So we've got a system. This is the hard part to change. We've got a government system that is paying farmers to do the wrong thing, where they know they can get that check every single year. They know they can get it no matter what, because it's part of a system, because the government gives them that money, versus a system where they will actually make money. Enough money to buy more land, send their kids to college, put money in retirement, pay taxes. You know, we're talking about the difference between a $90 billion industry that actually makes money and a $25 billion $25 billion liability that we as Americans have to pay every year. So the answer is ultimately economics. Mm-hmm. We have to begin to look at this like a, if the food is making excess nutrition, if the soil is making excess nutrition, the farmer is making excess money. So it's really, this is about getting young people involved in farming. It's about a new wave of people. The average farmer in the United States is 65 years old in the next 10 years. 40 million acres of land are going to be up for grabs. So it is not unthinkable that in 10 or 15 years, even 20 years at the outset, we will see a radical disruption. Just like we're seeing in all the other major traditional industries, we will see a radical disruption in farming so that farming is a carbon sequestering, profit-making business in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're basically, the appeal is opt out of that dependency and that kind of corrupted system where you're being paid to do the wrong thing. Go back to the inspiration that, the love of the land or the longstanding family, groundedness in farms that are passed down generations, do that instead. And so you're saying that with the younger generation coming in, more and more people are going to be wanting to do that. They're not wanting to be buying in to this corrupt system to just kind of skate by while harming the earth and the food supply. We've seen young people as this next generation comes in and starts, acting on and taking control of different areas. It certainly is consistent with their clarity of vision about where things are going rather than the stuckness, that we've had as an epidemic really here. So I think that is really hopeful. So you're saying that actually the climate change acceleration can be reversed through these practices over time. I mean, is this happening within the next 20 years going to be enough to save us? Or, what do you think?
I think we're going to see climate disruption regardless of what we do at this point. I think mm-hmm. we have to think long term. I think we have mm-hmm. to think about what, at this point, we have to dig in and we have to go, what are we handing to our children? Mm-hmm. Because if we just continue to increase CO2 in the atmosphere, and if we continue to allow governments of the world to attempt to do something about it, which is what all of these COP meetings are doing, mm-hmm. The reductions are going to be largely, they're going to be largely greenwashing. It's going to be largely lip speak. Yes, we're mm-hmm. going to see some great things. Solar is going to come online. That is inevitable. It's not an if, it's a when. The problem with the when, though, is let's say we went solar tomorrow, which would be great, and I'm all for it, and I've spent 20 years of my life advocating for renewable energy, and I'm never going to stop. We have solar on our house, we drive electric cars, so on and so on. Let's say we did that with the entire world tomorrow. We still have 1,500 gigatons, 1,500 billion tons of carbon dioxide that we've put into the atmosphere. What are we mm-hmm. doing about that? So the bigger question is not, are we going to stop burning fossil fuels? Economically, yes, that is inevitable. That is happening globally. Slowly in some parts, quickly in others, it's going to happen. It's not going to happen as a result of government, mandates. It's going to happen as a result of the fact that solar and wind are getting much cheaper and so are batteries, which we knew was going to happen all along. Now the new question is, what are we doing about the legacy load of carbon dioxide? Because we know as carbon dioxide goes up, water goes up. So we've got a tremendous amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. We've got a tremendous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. What is that doing? Let's look at hurricanes. Let's look at storms. Let's look at droughts. All of these things are directly related, not just to the CO2, but to the fact that we've ripped the water out of the soil and we've put it into the atmosphere. So we're getting bigger hurricanes, we're getting longer droughts, we're getting all of that. That's stuff where water needs to be in the soil, not in the atmosphere. So if we're going to really ameliorate those trends, we've got to pull that CO2 and that water vapor and put them back in the soil where they belong. And can it be done? It can absolutely be done. Is it profitable? It's profitable to the individuals who are going to engage in this, which is why I have great hope for millennials getting into this business. They're not a generation that likes to spray chemicals. They want to look at biology, and they want to pursue biology. I tell young people say, well, what should I pursue as a career path? You know, I'm thinking about going into coding. I say, don't go into coding. Everyone's going to code. Coding is going to be like spelling. Everyone's going to know how to code. Coding is a commodity game. Learn biology. Learn how to grow food. Learn about soil. This is the next. You know, we did a calculation just based on the soil-based carbon solutions available globally. It is a $10 trillion. It's a $10 trillion industry over the course of 10 to 20 years. That's how much money will be made doing forest restoration, ameliorating the soil. I mean, this is where the next generation of food is going to come from. Yes, mm-hmm. There will be vertical gardens and all of that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, the soil is the only way to produce enough food to feed this planet.
Mhm. Mhm. And you know, where are the lands? Are they in the United States? Are they in other countries? You know, what is the international participation or perspective on this?
It is growing. The French Minister of Agriculture, and we detail this in the Kiss the Ground book, the whole first chapter of the book is I get embedded with the French government, and I get to follow the French Minister of Agriculture, Stéphane Le Foll, through his efforts to create an international consortium of countries that are signing on to doing regenerative agriculture. And in Europe, they call it agroecology. But it's the same stuff. It's the same principles. So, you know, the whole first chapter of the book really details the international challenge and the international efforts. And what we see is countries that have not signed on completely to the chemical industrial agricultural complex are more willing to change. So we're seeing a lot of interest in Africa. We're seeing many nations in Africa are signing on to agroecology because they've got a pressing need to feed people, and they don't have the money to buy into the chemical system. So I have great hope for Africa. I have great hope for China, ironically. Even though China is very industrial, very science-based, they also have a pressing need to feed a lot of people, and their soils are extremely... I think we're actually going to see faster movement. Not that we're not going to see movement in the U.S., but I think we're going to see faster movement in Asia. I think we're going to see faster movement in Africa. And I think, thirdly, we're going to see South America coming on because so much of the lungs of the planet, the Amazon, other regions that were previously forested have been deforested, that we can now use these principles to reforest and grow food at the same time. So I think it's actually going to be the developing world that grabs this faster. And we're going to see a lot of results from there. And then the United States is going to be a very quick change. I think we're going to see a change within... You've got to think about the United States production agriculture. Soy, corn, canola, all this stuff wasn't grown 50 years ago. You know, it really came on after World War II. And it came on in a very short period of time. 10 years, we changed the entire agriculture of the United States. And so I think we're going to see a similar change. Probably we're going to see overseas take this on first, and then when the United States sees in mass that it's working, it is going to be a very fast change in this country to this type of agriculture.
Well, that's interesting. So we'll be lagging, but then at some point it's going to become incredibly obvious. What about the role of, you know, when you mention Africa, and I'm someone who's had the good fortune to, you know, spend time in Africa many years back, but, you know, it never leaves your heart, really. You know, what about the role of somebody like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation? I mean, they seem to, you know... There seems to be an American philanthropic model, or purportedly philanthropic model, you know, where we're going to come over and help you in ways perhaps that the local people don't really want. And we, you know, and the cover story is that this is a great philanthropy, But underneath, it's really very often in a resource grab, by the large companies that are, sensibly coming in, or, foundations, private foundations that are coming in to help. I mean, I feel very heartened to think of the kind of agricultural development that you're talking about occurring in Africa. I mean, it would just be ripe for it. But, I mean, are there opposing forces, that are sort of wanting things to go in a different direction?
We've a long history of sort of the white man coming in with their industrial ideas and, instituting those onto people in Africa. And I think I made a movie in Nigeria, and it was really eye-opening to see the perspective from a country where the average person makes a dollar a day, and there's 120 million people, 100 million of which are hungry. So I think that the Gates Foundation, all of that, there may be, at the end of the day, a very strong desire to help and to use that money to do good. But so many of these foundations fall into the same trap, which is, let's use the methods that have destroyed the world to try and rebuild the world. And that is chemistry and physics. We used, physics to chop down trees. We used physics to enslave people. The physics of a gun, the physics of a large ship, the physics of a better army. And then we used chemistry to sort of harness the world and form it into our own image. And none of that is a long-term solution. I think what this is that we're talking about in Kiss the Ground, the Kiss the Ground book, Kiss the Ground is on Amazon for those of you who want to get it right away. It's a really great read, is that we've got an opportunity to use education to empower people. This is not about the latest tech. It's not about the new gadget. It's not about the thing that we're going to get them addicted to so that they buy it over and over again, that they become indebted to us in some way, shape, or form, economically or socially. It is about empowering people to understand how soil works. And when you understand how soil works, it doesn't take long to get the basics. This education, takes literally, once you read a couple of books, you can be super empowered. The entire education may take a lifetime, but within a week, you can be savvy enough to really be on the path. And once you understand that, you can grow a tremendous amount of food, tremendous amount more food in the same area. You can begin to establish local water cycles again. You can sequester carbon dioxide. So at the very bottom of this is a regenerative model where you're making your local area better and you're making your community better because they're better fed. That basic education is what I think is going to be more easily spread than GMOs and chemicals. And for that reason, that's why I think that all of these big foundations that are spending money trying to get the third world interested in first world chemicals and first world technologies, which we know degrade the soil, they're going to fail. Some of them are just going to fail completely, and some of them may actually hear this information and go, oh, we should actually do something that's long-term, not short-term. So I think the foundations themselves need to be disrupted. And that's gonna happen as a result of this information being available now.
I love your take on that. That's really hopeful and important to address because, they're out there. A lot of people still aren't connecting the dots on this supposed beneficence and its real, kind of underbelly effects as you describe them, and I completely concur. So I think that's really terrific. What about the fact that having already disseminated these chemicals everywhere, I mean, even, societies that don't use these products, that don't use this form of agriculture, they've pervaded the planet. Are we at a point where the existing state of toxicity of the soil or the water is such that, that's a major problem and it's going to be a much tougher challenge, or would be if we waited, let's say, another 10 years, to grow healthy food in soil has been contaminated by the very industries and modes that you just so aptly described.
Well, there's two sides to this. One is we have no choice. We have mm-hmm. no choice. We have to use degraded land because that's virtually the only land we have. We've got a 10,000-year history of civilizations degrading their land. And Arnold Toynbee, the famous historian who wrote the opus called, you know, Civilizations, he detailed 25 societies that went through this process. And, you know, in not so many words, if you look at Toynbee's work, all of those, okay, maybe with the exception of one or two societies, fell because they degraded their basic resource. The basic resource of civilization is not money, it's not gold, it's not water, it's soil. It's mm-hmm. soil. That is how a civilization operates. Because when you grow food, food is the stability. Grain is the stability, the long-term stability of a civilization. When the soil goes, the grain goes, the food goes, the civilization goes. It's happened, we know, over 10,000 years. So we have a 10,000-year history of degrading the soil. We now have a global civilization. It's the first one. And we're accelerating the degradation of our soils. So the stakes are very, very high. This is a very real game. This is a civilization-level event that we're talking about, how we deal with this civilization-level event. Like, this is the same as a large meteor the size of the moon hitting the Earth. That's the level of event that we're talking about, because we're talking about the ability to feed or not feed 10 billion people. So my philosophy on this is very simple. We have to use the soil we have. We have many examples of nature being regenerative. Nature's default pattern is to regenerate, even with heavy toxicity. Look at one of the worst incidents in our global history of toxicity, Chernobyl. The area around Chernobyl has been cordoned off since the 1980s when that happened, and we see now tremendous growth of natural ecosystem restoration in that area without intervention. So species have gone through the roof. We see an increased flora, increased fauna. It's really a new ecosystem that has been born. Now, is there residual toxicity? Absolutely. Is there background radiation? You know, absolutely. But what we know is, in spite of levels of toxicity, whether it's soil or radiation or something that's been sprayed like Corexit in the Gulf of Mexico, nature by default is restorative. Nature will circumnavigate that toxicity and begin to thrive. And so the question is, are we going to harness that power or continue to try to push it down? Because when we become collaborators, when we become partners in the natural power, the dumas, the power of life, as it's called in Latin, we participate in something far more powerful than what we've developed. We've developed sprays. We've developed machines. Great. Those cannot hold a candle to the restorative power of nature, which is why in a handful of healthy soil, you hold more organisms than people who've lived on Earth, and it's why we don't fully understand the soil. It's a power that is able to take heavy toxins and break them down. We know mushrooms can break down heavy toxins. Well, the largest living organism on Earth is a fungus, right? It's probably the oldest living organism, too, hundreds and hundreds of years old, maybe thousands of years old. So we have a natural intelligence inside the soil and inside these ecosystems that, when harnessed, if we say, oh, we've got a lot of ALAR, we've got a lot of diminazide, we've got a lot of paraquat, we've got a lot of 2,4-D, we've got a lot of glyphosate in the system, what can we bring in biologically to begin to break that down? And there's always something biologically that can work with whatever man has put on the land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's really... So in other words, the Earth itself has regenerative capacities. You know, if we get out of the way, really, is what all of this is about, getting out of the way, rather than pursuing these economic goals that, you know, as we have seen them develop, are really becoming less and less attractive to the general population, because they're only enriching, you know, a very narrow, tiny sector of society. And the notion that, you know, it's all going to trickle down to ordinary people, which was, you know, originally that trickle-down theory was articulated in the 80s under the Reagan administration. And, you know, at the time it sounded good. And people believed it for many, many years, you know, because it was based on an act of nature. Water trickles down. You know, it also rises up and evaporates back up into the atmosphere. But, you know, because they used a metaphor from a self-evident natural process, you know, it made it all, you know, it validated it. But in fact, it's the opposite is the case. So there's really very little reason for the mass of people to continue supporting this system that's both disenfranchising people, economically stripping them, and then having all of the, you know, impacts on life itself, on our ability to live and be healthy, and that of, you know, in other species and all humans. So it becomes less and less attractive. I mean, what do you see as happening, you know, as new forms of disruptive infrastructure that can, you know, help people get onto, you know, leave the bad track and get onto the better track? Have you thought that part of it, you know, through to any extent?
One of the things that I spent a lot of time in the Kiss the Ground book doing is really empowering people. So when you get your book, you know, go to chapter 10, and it is one whole chapter of resources. So it's not just web links. It's really a distillation of things you can do, including, you know, I have a lot of young people already coming up to me in the Kiss the Ground lectures and talks and in the book tour that we're doing. I have a lot of young people coming up to me and saying, I want to get out on the land. I want to farm. I want to do this right now. Show me how to do this. I take out a book. I turn to chapter 10 and I go, start with item number one, and you work your way through chapter 10. When you're done, you will learn how to get money for farming. You will learn how to get land. You will learn how to change your diet. Diet is a huge part of this, and that's something that any city dweller can do. If you're sick, if your body is not well, then your mind is not well. And if your mind is not well, you cannot access this information in a good way. You can't see the possibilities, right? So the first thing you've got to do is get the toxic foods out of your body. And as your body gets healthier, what you're going to see is the foods you're choosing are soil-supporting foods. How do you do that? Well, you know, we don't have time, Allison, unfortunately, to go through everything in the book in the talk we're doing today. But essentially, here's what I tell people. Of course, get a copy of Kiss the Ground, the book, because it's really the manual for this transformation. Once you transform, you'll see these possibilities too. Two, get outside. Take off your shoes. Get your bare feet on the sand of the beach. Get your bare feet on the grass. Get your bare feet on the forest floor. And just spend 5 minutes in nature. Be silent. Just be aware of what's happening around you and connect physically with nature. The microbes in the soil can exchange with your actual microbes in your body through the pores in your feet. So,
you know, this
is a very powerful process.
Here, Josh, because we're coming now to the end of our time speaking with you.
That's it.
But I just want to say what you're describing here is literally kiss the ground, you know, walk on the ground, kiss the ground, you know, as a first step. Where can listeners get the Kiss the Ground book, because you know, you can get the book, read the book, and be involved, as well as go to your website. So please let people know how they can do that, right?
Sure. KissTheGroundBook.com. 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 You can also go to Amazon, any Barnes & Noble store, and of course, we're very active on Facebook, Kiss the Ground and Kiss the Ground Book.
Thank you so much for being with us today and Connect the Dots. Josh Patel, author of Kiss the Ground. And thank you, listeners. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rosie.